Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and on today's episode, we take a look at the Champions League round of 16, the results, the format so far, and what we're looking forward to in the next round. Then we open up the burn book. Before over on the paid side, we look at players outside the top five leagues who we think could make a big impact at the highest level, and we answer a raft of your questions in anything but football. That's all on today's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So we're back for another Unseen Incidents. And when I say we, I do mean we, because I'm joined by Pete Dorman, Daddy Pete Dorman.
Hello. Just a couple of daddies hanging out.
Exactly. Well, it was always that.
Well, no, I feel it's always been that with you. I think with me more, it needs to be, I actually do need a child. I feel mm-hmm. that at least with the FD fandom, you were perceived as a daddy long before you actually were a father.
That might be true.
I don't feel that I've had the same... The optics are different for me.
That's definitely true. I think that, you know, I'm more of a bear and yeah. you're more of a... I don't know if you're a full twink, but you might be between a twink and an otter. Is there something in there?
What's an otter?
So an otter, I think, is like... An otter has like the sort of hairiness of a bear, but is, I think, a kind of slimmer, lither... type. This is my understanding.
Yeah.
This is very outdated stuff, yeah. I'm sure. Like I haven't kept abreast of the developments in gay technology, so I don't really know where we are.
I don't think otter is appropriate because it's basically like neck down, smooth like a seal.
Exactly.
So
a seal. Because you've got the moustache as well, so maybe you're more of a walrus right now.
So yeah, I was forbidden to have a moustache for my wedding.
Mm-hmm.
I was fine with just videoing that because it is a potentially incredibly dating aesthetic.
I guess.
Because it does, you know, it was what, in fashion in the 70s, and now it's only just come back into fashion. So
yeah.
You're thinking like you could very quickly, horrendously date your wedding photo. So I was fine with that. But now that, you know, married with child, I was like, there is no better time to just regrow the mustache than fatherhood.
So your baby will be imprinting on this fighter pilot face that you've
this
got.
This was like a genuine thought process, because I've seen a lot of videos of like fathers who had beards and their children have only known them to have beards, to then shave their beards and get the reaction. And the reaction is almost always like apoplectic. They're always like terrified,
rightly
or
so.
They cry, whatever, because like their father has completely changed their look and they just don't know how to process that. So I figured if I grandfather in the mustache, I can almost force my hand and I can't lose it, or it'll
yeah,
be more
sure.
difficult to lose it, because the child takes comfort from this, like you say, a fighter pilot. We'll leave what side of fighter pilot unspoken.
I think we both know.
Yeah, we both know, but we don't need to say it.
I think we both know. Okay, so you, this is you attempting to like circumnavigate Jess's disapproval
yeah.
by creating a psychological need for the moustache yeah. in your child.
While also being my unofficial audition for Band of Brothers remake, if that happened.
But that would
obviously
be great.
On the wrong side.
Yeah, of course, on the wrong
yeah,
side.
Yeah, yeah,
you'd just
yeah.
be there shouting like, Achtung, and like...
yeah, yeah.
That's the wrong war, right?
I mean, I think they're both appropriate.
But it feels more First World War, I think, your moustache.
But I think the Second World War just has more pageantry about it.
I agree.
Yeah.
You know, and also, you know, the First World War, you're just fighting Germans and they're just like normal guys. Whereas in the Second World War, it's like they're cartoon villains.
Sure.
Because you're like, oh, they're not Germans, they're the Nazis.
Yeah.
So you don't have to feel bad about like blowing them up and shit. But I don't know. I just think it's got more of a...
I don't know.
I honestly think you look like an English fighter pilot. I just think that you have German tendencies. You know?
Yeah. Is it...
Tyrannical agenda.
That makes it sound like my look is British, but my beliefs are just fascist.
I mean, where do you want me to go with that?
In a world where fascism or the acceptability of fascism is significantly growing, it's a difficult or dangerous position to put yourself in.
Okay, that is a fair point. Yeah, maybe we should move on from that. Okay, so today we're going to talk a little bit about the Champions League. You know, Pete is back with us earlier than we expected, and we've missed a whole round of the Champions League, not missed it, but we haven't really talked about it. And it wrapped up last night with some big results. We've got some interesting Champions League quarterfinals set up. We've got PSG, Villa, Barcelona, Dortmund, Bayern, Inter, and Arsenal, Real Madrid. So, I mean, I would say, I don't know, but Barca Dortmund is the only one there that I think is genuine kind of garbage, but it's still worth watching for Barca. I mean, I do expect PSG to batter Villa, but I do think that all the fixtures are pretty interesting. So what do we think? I guess the first question is, like, what do we think of the format? Because we were quite critical of it early on in the season, and God, we've had like a load of extra fixtures. You know, we're now in the quarterfinals, but we've played two extra league phase games, and we've had an extra playoff round in there. So we basically had like four games extra by this stage of the season. And it does sort of feel like the Champions League has never gone away. Whereas normally you get that period of early December to February where you're excited for the Champions League, but it's not back yet. So have you changed your opinion on the new format, or is it as it was?
So I think the only time we spoke about the Champions League was before it started. I don't think we've actually properly touched on the Champions League like in a full segment on itself since then. And I kind of feel like too much of a good thing is what the Champions League this season is.
Sure.
But weirdly, like, the narrative that I'm seeing pushed around it from broadcasters, and, you know, obviously they've got a vested interest to make the product as sellable as possible, and also, so I think a lot of it is that. But, like, a lot of people are saying, like, oh, this is such a good iteration or such a good example of, you know, top-level football. We're seeing, like, the biggest teams play each other regularly. And there's like the drama of, you know, Man City having to win their last league game to make the playoffs. And it's like, I don't know why they're ramping up this drama when this drama already existed in the Champions League before. Like, it's not uncommon for a big team to have to win their last league game to finish second or finish first. Like, maybe they've struggled. And none of this, nothing is really different in the Champions League from the top end. I think everything is different in the bottom end, because you look at the teams that are now in the quarterfinal, you look at the teams that are in the round of 16, basically everything is super, super predictable. Like, obviously, people struggled, like Madrid struggled, City struggled, they had to go through playoffs, and obviously City went out. But one big team going out, I said, like, City are the one big team that went out, didn't make the knockouts proper. That isn't unheard of in the Champions League. Like, usually, once every few seasons, like, a big, big team will fuck up their league, fuck up their group stage, and finish third and drop into the Champions League or the Europa League. That's not unheard of. Every other big team made it to the knockouts proper. And if you look at all of the teams that went out in the league stage, every one of them is kind of believable. And then you have this, basically you have this scenario that's been created where the small teams might get to the playoffs and might get lucky. So like Club Brugge, fantastic to see them get as far as they did. But by and large, the big teams a lot of the big teams stumbled and had horrendous, like PSG had a horrendous start. I think they lost three of their first five in the league, and they look like they will be certainties almost for a semi-final. And whereas you look at a team like Lille, who, you know, they beat Madrid, they beat somebody else,
Atleti, both Madrid teams.
They automatically qualified for the knockouts, and then they still didn't make the round of 16. Oh, they got knocked out of the round 16.
But they did get rewarded by having, like, Dortmund, who are not very good.
Sure.
Like, as in, like, it wasn't like they got Barcelona and you were like, oh, well, there's no way through. Like, they could easily have gone through against Dortmund.
But my point is more that it's just because they're a smaller team than the European elite, they did everything right and then came up against Dortmund and were like, they lost that. Whereas, like, if you're, say, a PSG, they could do everything wrong and then come up against Dortmund in the round of last 32, round 16, and then just batter them because they're just a better, bigger team. And I think
not the case?
I just think the scope for big teams progressing further has been widened, and the scope for smaller teams progressing further has been shortened. or not?
Okay, so you get more. So if you get more chances, then overall,
the probability
the better, richer teams are gonna figure it out, and the poorer teams are not gonna be able to luck through to the final.
Exactly. So
okay,
there's a load of times where a smaller team just needs to get like one really good result and then just hold out for a second or whatever. Like they don't need a huge amount of results to kind of progress further than they would have expected. With this league system, because there's so many games plus the playoffs, and then you're into the round of proper knockouts with two legs, the amount of luck needed, or I mean maybe luck's the wrong word, but the amount of like good results needed, upset results needed for smaller teams is just it's just more unattainable than ever before. And it feels like these smaller teams, while they're involved, there's like this invisible ceiling that's like put on top of them, and that the big super elite super clubs sit above that, in that basically on the like laws of probability, the vast majority of those big teams will make it through to minimum quarterfinal stages, just because the format kind of helps them do that. And there was a huge fuss about the European Super League when it came and left. This doesn't feel that different to me, to be honest. I know there are more teams involved in it, but this feels like the first stages, the early stages of a legitimate European Super League, because we're already in a league system and it feels entirely geared towards the big 6, 7, 8 clubs in Europe, and everybody else is just there for kind of show and taking part. And whether they, you know, this competition continues in the same way with the same amount of teams, sure. But if in 10 years you see a league, like a Champions League A and a Champions League B or whatever, I don't know, but like a system where it has just the elite teams playing more games regularly, I wouldn't be shocked, because this to me feels like the first stages of a genuine European Super League, because it just feels like it's so impossible for any smaller team to make it to like the quarterfinals or semifinals.
Okay. So, I mean, I like kind of agree with this in a sense, as in, I don't think that this has just solved the problem of, you know, making life easier for smaller teams, if that was a problem that they were attempting to solve. And even if it did solve that problem, it hasn't done a good enough job to necessarily warrant 4 extra games. So I think some people are praising the new format as well because of stuff that I think is kind of a fluke. So Real Madrid, Man City and PSG all having to like play for survival on the final day or whatever, I don't think that that's because of the new structure. I just think that just happened to be the case this year, and it's less likely to be the case in future years. Like to me, that's a bit of a... Like, Man City being this bad, a fluke. PSG were crap before they got good. Real Madrid were figuring out the Mbappe issue and had a bunch of injuries. Like, I don't know. I don't think it's going to be like that in a normal year.
And also, I think there's an element where, because it's the first iteration of a new format... people were like, oh, we got loads of games. Like there was less pressure on getting a result from each individual game, certainly at the start. And then they obviously all stumbled at the start and were like, oh, we kind of...
Sure.
It's now a little bit more important. Whereas with the group stages, I kind of feel like you can slip up once, maybe twice, but the weight placed on most of those games is significantly more. Because it's like, you basically need to finish first.
Or you kind of need 10 points to be safe as well. But like, okay.
Kind of you finishing second is fine, but you're probably going to get a really difficult draw in the next round.
Sure. But like, I don't know. I do still think that we've had better quality fixtures than we would normally have had. Like, Man City going out in the playoffs is still a big deal. Liverpool going out in the round of 16 is still a big deal. Even Leverkusen going out is pretty big. Atleti going out is pretty big. Like, those are big clubs to go out. And actually, as well, if the Italian sides had got their shit together, then we would have had, you know, Arsenal, Juve, Inter Milan, or maybe the other way around. Maybe it would have been Inter Juve. And we'd have had Villa versus Atalanta. So actually, Club Bruges getting through to the round of 16 is good. Feyenoord, PSV. Club Bruges could easily have beaten Villa. Like, I don't know. I just think that... I don't think it's that crazy. I do actually think it's given smaller clubs a little bit more of a shake in the knockouts, or at least it seems to have this year. It might just be that a bunch of the super clubs are in kind of bad spots, and that might be more of a factor. But I don't know. I think that we've had at least one standout match in every stage. To have Real Madrid, Man City in the round of 16, to have Liverpool, PSG, and Real Madrid, Atleti, and even Leverkusen, Bayern, which was a crappy fixture, but it should have been better. To have all of those in the round of 16, I think is quite positive. And yeah, I mean, they're basically 1.5 unpredictable teams in the quarterfinals, I guess. Like Dortmund. Dortmund are less predictable than we think.
Dortmund?
If Dortmund had a different name, a team of this quality being where they are now would be surprising. But it's only because we associate Dortmund with European pedigree that we're not surprised.
Dortmund are crap.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. Like, if Dortmund were... If it was Sporting there, we would all be like, wow, that's crazy. But just because of the name Dortmund, we're not saying that. But Dortmund are crap.
They're 10th in the Bundesliga and they sacked their manager like 2 months ago.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of wild they're there, but we're not treating it as wild because it's Borussia Dortmund. They made the final last year. Villa's a difficult one. Like, Villa, the name doesn't feel like it belongs here, but like... They are obviously an incredibly rich side who went and signed like Rashford and Asensio in January. So anyway, I don't know. I'm quite excited about the knockout. So what do you think? What have you thought about the fixture so far? Because I wonder if we should just quickly deal with Liverpool PSG. Because every time I've said anything negative about Liverpool over these two fixtures, I've got so much shit on Twitter
about it. I've been seeing this, like, you know, from the outside on just viewing your Twitter, or whenever you pop up on Twitter, you're just taking, like, shit for saying Liverpool are shit or Liverpool have been shit.
I know, it was actually nice about the first leg, which, I mean, they turned in one of the most disgusting performances I've ever seen from them in Europe. Yeah. And I was much nicer about it than everybody else, even though they had two shots away from home and it was an absolute disgraceful performance.
Yeah.
And it was not like, oh, we weathered the storm and then stole a goal. It was, we got insanely lucky and went through.
PSG had 27 shots in that game.
Yeah, and then in the second leg, I was like, at half time, I said, people are talking about it being even, but it's not. Like, PSG are all over them. And someone said, it's been a pretty even game. And I posted the thing where it was like, halftime, Liverpool 1 XG, PSG 2. And he said, yeah, that's basically even. And I was like, what planet do you live on? I think he was like,
that's basically even if you take out the biggest chance of
the shot they had on the line. Yeah. And I said, yeah, if you take out their biggest chance, then I guess then they created more XG than you. Plus, they had a shot on the line.
Yeah,
that's what you're saying. And he was just like, no, it's basically even including that shot on the line. And I was like, no, it isn't. To concede 2 expected goals in half a game of football is an awful lot. To concede twice as much XG as you have put up after a half is crazy. And at the end of it, the aggregate expected goals, PSG 4.2, Liverpool 1.9. That is extremely comprehensive. Liverpool are a great team, but PSG were better in both games. And as much as I want to say, I thought Slot made good adjustments in both legs. I thought in the second half of both legs, they were significantly better. In the first leg, okay, they only had one shot, but I thought they had some really dangerous counters. In the second leg, they were dominant in the second half, though without really creating much of anything. I thought those were good adjustments. I was impressed. At the same time, the only reason those adjustments could have mattered is because PSG failed to put the game away in the first half, which they should have done in both fixtures. Like, PSG was so good in the first half of both games that they should have been 2 or 3-0 up at the break, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think there's very little to kind of sing about if you're a Liverpool fan, because I think these are just two very lackluster performances and they were absolutely deserved to go out. Obviously, the first leg was horrendous performance. You know, I think PSG had 70% possession. And I think that's Liverpool's lowest return on possession this season. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of indicative of their performance generally. I think no Liverpool player had more than one successful dribble, whereas Dembele and Vitinha completed 9 between them. Like, that was very much the kind of the run of the game. And I think they were better in the second leg. They were significantly better in the second leg.
Oh, yeah, way better.
But they were still outperformed in shots on target, chances created, possession, expected goals, all at Anfield as well. So I think having such a terrible first leg, and while a better second leg, but you're still being outperformed in all of like these key metrics at home, I don't think you can really be annoyed that you went out, because whether PSG are a better team or not isn't the case. It's just that PSG can significantly play better across two legs.
Yeah. And I think there's the tendency as well to overestimate the chances your team had. So, I mean, Salah normally puts away half chances. And so it's understandable that... So people are saying, oh, you know, Liverpool had two massive chances early on in that second leg. And you're like, they had pretty big chances. Yeah. They had the one that, like, gets cleared not off the line, but like Nuno Mendes blocks it basically and it goes over the bar. And then they had another one where Salah kind of comes inside and you thought this is going in and it goes wide. But equally, Barcola went clear through on goal and took a bad touch, you know, and Alisson smothers it. Kvicha had a free shot from the top of the box with everybody out of position that got deflected just over the bar. And it was just this attitude of like, oh, well, we should have been 2-0 up by the time they scored. And I just thought, well, yeah, if you'd scored two goals from like 0.5 XG, then yes, that would be true. But that actually doesn't happen very often, even when you're Liverpool. So I don't know, like, I guess there's only so much we want to harp on about the game, but PSG look really, really dangerous and exciting. The one thing with them is I thought in both legs, they did get weaker as the game went on. They were good in extra time in the second leg, but like the second half, they were bad. Mm. And I really love Désiré Doué, but I think in both legs, when he's come on, he's really fun, but they do start taking bad shots. I'm not saying this is his fault, but it's like an adjustment that happens when he comes on. It feels like with PSG, if you can get through to about 60 minutes and you're level or leading or basically in touch with the game, then they will drop off a bit because there's only so long they can maintain that insane high press. There's only so long that they want to run out that front three of Kvicha, Barker and Ousmane Dembele. So looking at both those matches, I thought, yeah, I think they'll beat Villa because Villa are not as good as Liverpool. But at the same time, if Villa manage to luck through to kind of 55, 60 minutes and there's one goal in the game or it's level, I do think that hitting guys, if you can start then hitting Watkins, Asensio and Rashford, I don't think that that's unconcerning for PSG.
I agree with that. I just don't see a genuine roadmap to Villa getting past them because if this was a final, sure. But the fact that this is across two legs, that means that you don't need to get to 60 minutes at nil all once. You need to do it twice, including away from home. And with the firepower that PSG have had, like, I didn't expect a huge amount from PSG this season in the Champions League, but like, they, for me, they're dark horses now for genuine winners, because they've got Villa in the quarterfinals, then we'll assume they'll get past that, then they're facing Arsenal and Madrid. I don't think are fantastic. Arsenal are damaged by injury, so you're looking at their route to the final thinking, for as how lethal they've been up front, very, very manageable route. Again, like a semi-final against Arsenal or Madrid is going to be very, very tough, but a fairly manageable route for this PSG team, a far more manageable route than I thought it would have been had they reached this stage at the start of the season. But if you look at like Barcola and Dembele, like they've 64 goal involvements in all competitions between them. 64, mm-hmm. Which is insane.
It's crazy.
There's five other players in double figures for goal involvements as well. So their attack has been like absolutely purring. Obviously there's Ligue 1 effects there, but the fact that they're 16 points clear at the top of their domestic league makes it really easy for them to focus on the Champions League. You know, Madrid are in a title race with Barca. I think they're the same point. They're 57 points at the time of recording with Barcelona, but Barcelona have a game in hand. Arsenal, obviously, kind of in the back end of a title race, whether you still call it a title race, with Liverpool.
Well, they're just thin. They've got Saka to come back, but that's the last remaining real reinforcement that Arsenal have got coming.
But Arsenal will also be still very, very, very focused domestically.
Arsenal, I think, are so comfortable, like...
What, and just finishing second?
They can't win the league, but they're not going to drop out of the top five. It's just not possible. They're better than all the other teams and they've got points advantage. Like, so unless a couple of bad results go against them and they're really worried, then maybe. But like, to me, if I'm PSG, I think Villa, Arsenal, Inter is probably my nightmare run. Even though I think that Barcelona...
I think that's what happened too.
Interesting. Because I think, but you know, Barcelona are the best team left in it.
Arsenal, it'll be Villa, Arsenal, Barca. It'll be an Inter-Barca semi-final, I think.
Okay. So that's the thing, though. Like, Arsenal are a much better defensive team than Liverpool. Liverpool, the league is like here defensively, and then way above it is Liverpool, and then way above them are Arsenal. Mm-hmm. And Inter are the same, because they're not only a good defensive team, like, in their organisation, but they're also really big, like a big physical side. And the one thing with PSG is that you're like, they don't have great defenders. And so Liverpool have amazing attackers and they do have great defenders, but their midfield isn't great defensively. And so they kind of got to press really hard. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens if PSG go up against a team who are very comfortable defending deep and are a physical mismatch for their guys and then have a little bit of something on the break, you know, because Arsenal can play these Champions League knockouts like Atletico Madrid. Like Real Madrid against Arsenal now, like watching it last night, I thought, oh, if you're an Arsenal fan, you should be preferring to play Real Madrid here.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
Real Madrid look like they've got no fucking ideas against Atleti. And Arsenal
again,
should have
defensively structured teams, Real Madrid have no idea.
And they've got bad defenders. You know, a load of their defenders are injured. So you look at that game and you're like, well, if Arsenal just play a solid defence and they have Saka back, and then they're like, right, okay, well, we leave Saka and Martinelli forward and our aim is just to get it up to them. I'm not saying it's a perfect game plan. Sometimes you lose, but that is not who Real Madrid want to play. And it's not who PSG want to play. Now, PSG are they're playing in a much more coherent way than Real Madrid at the moment. But that side of the draw, I think, is PSG go through, but the other side I think is quite unpredictable. I'd probably give Arsenal the edge despite Real Madrid's like Champions League voodoo. But then if it's a PSG Real, I would say PSG. PSG Arsenal is more of an interesting question. Bayern Inter I think is a genuinely fascinating fixture because again it's a slightly similar thing, right? Bayern have got a really good attack. Their defense is a bit dodgy. If you can play out from the defense, you get the midfield running backwards very, very quickly because they go man-to-man so high up. Inter have huge guys and a couple of great passers at the back. And so their aim is going to be like, well, we win the ball back and Calhanoglu or Bastoni hits Di Marco or Thuram and we see what happens. And I think Bayern could have a really unpleasant game against Inter.
Bayern and Inter is an attack that's cooking, coming up against a defence that's cooking. You know, Inter have conceded two goals. We're in the quarterfinals now. Inter have conceded two goals in the tournament.
Yeah, but that is pretty lucky.
Yeah, sure, but it is still an insane stat to think. Mm-hmm. And also, so I think Bayern have a huge amount of attacking entities at their disposal. Inter have always been a famously structured and solid defence. And I think in some ways those two things could go a long way in cancelling each other out. And then it comes down to things like, do I back Inzaghi over Kompany? Every single fucking day of the week, I back Inzaghi over Kompany. Kompany is basically a PE teacher trying to teach Harry Kane enough English to get him to pass his BTEC in sport.
That is a strong opinion. But like, he's done a good job there. But yeah, I think basically every time, except in these last games against Leverkusen, where I thought Leverkusen just made a bunch of mistakes. Every time he's come up against a good manager this season, I do think Kompany has been outcoached.
And I don't think that's shocking. I don't think that's controversial to say because I don't think Kompany should be in the position where he's in. I don't think he has the experience to justify being given that job.
Sure.
I think there could have been far better appointments made, but he is here. He is doing whatever. He's going to win the Bundesliga, but honestly, that is not a really... like, that's not a metric of to define success because... it's Bayern Munich winning the Bundesliga is essentially an absolute expectation.
Yes.
And the rarity is that they don't win it. If you were to take a Bayern job, but if either of us were to take this Bayern job and we're given four seasons, it would be a catastrophic failure if we didn't have at least one Bundesliga title at the end of it.
I reckon I'd win two titles literally just by being like, just go out there and express yourselves, boys.
Just by letting the boys play. Let the boys play.
Even if we lost every game against the good teams, even if we lost like both Leverkusen games every season, I'd be like, doesn't matter, I'm going to win the league. Like, it doesn't matter. Because there's always a fixture. Like, there was that Dinamo Zagreb one. Was it Zagreb? In the autumn, where I said to somebody before the game, I was like, Bayern will score at least 7 goals in this game. And was it like 9-2 or something?
You said you wanted to put it on because you said there's going to be like loads of goals in this.
It's just there were tons of goals. Like, you know they'll do it. Like, they do it every couple of seasons where they go out there on autopilot and one of their players has a good game and they just ball out for 90 minutes and destroy them. And look, that's totally possible in this game. It's possible that like Musiala or Lise has just an insane game. It's obviously totally possible that Kane puts away a couple of half chances. But I do think that at the end of the two legs, we will look at it and say Inter had answers for them.
Yeah.
And Inzaghi's game plan was overall better than Bayern's. If Bayern won, I do think it'll be because of like individual quality.
Which you can't really mitigate for, because it's like I think this is, it's the same scenario the Madrid and Arsenal are in. I think Arsenal are the better team, and I think across two legs Arsenal should win that. But Real Madrid do have superstars who have the ability to just do something. And like Arsenal have superstars as well, depending if Saka's fit or not. But having players like Mbappe and Vinicius or Musiala, Kane, their ability to just do something out of nothing and, you know, just steal a win that is completely undeserved still exists. But I think probability-wise, I think Inter are, at worst, as good a team as Bayern and have a better manager. And across two legs, I think that'll become evident. And they're also playing more conservatively, so I think they don't need to score a load. They just do, like, they're not going to concede a lot against Bayern.
Yeah.
So as long as they can grab a few goals, like two or three goals across the two legs, I don't see it being overly difficult for them. This is this is an ideal scenario. Again, half chances can be put away. Very low XG chances can just find the back of the net, and that turns everything on its head. But I back Inter to kind of navigate past company and Bayern.
Yeah, I do as well. And I mean, I it'll be interesting if they do get past them and then play Barcelona, who I think in some ways are like the evolutionary Bayern. You know, like they've got... I think they've got a better attack. Yeah, exactly. I think they've got at least as good an attack. They've got, you know, just as much individual quality. They have a more structured press. They have a better manager.
Better manager.
Defensively, like, is their individual quality as good? Like, probably not. But I do just think that their organization makes up for it. Yeah. That'll be interesting as well. Because if Inter get past Bayern, then they'll look at Barcelona and think, well, we all know what the weaknesses are here. And the question is, can you exploit the weaknesses enough to make up for the fact that they are going to create against you? But you look at these Benfica fixtures and like, yeah, there was a red card in the first leg and obviously Barcelona go through, but it's very even on expected goals. It's like four apiece on expected goals. In fact, Benfica had the slight edge and Benfica have been pretty dangerous all through it. And they're unlucky that they've had to play Barcelona three times.
Yeah.
But I would look at that match if I were Inter and I'd think, yeah, this is not like an impregnable team. Like Barcelona have had some bad runs this season, and if we can replicate that, you know, the kind of Pavlidis Alvaro Carreras like axis that really got some traction for them, like if we could do that with Di Marco and Thuram, or Di Marco and Lautaro Martinez or whatever, then that's quite interesting. The bigger issue, I think, for these teams, like same for Arsenal, it's like, how fit are Arsenal going to be? How fit is Saka going to be? For Inter, they've had a bunch of injuries. How fit are their key players going to be? Because they are quite old and quite thin. They've got a three-way title race, which is now against two teams who don't have this second competition to think about. Like, that's a bit of a concern.
I mean, Serie A generally is super congested at the top end, even outside of the top three.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Like, a couple of results and, like, Juve would be in the hunt.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's interesting that that there are three games here that are a defensive team versus a more attacking team. And I would say that the Arsenal-Real Madrid one is the most finely balanced, because I think Arsenal have maybe the best defence of the three. It's certainly better than Villa's. It's at least as good as Inter's. And Real Madrid, I think, are the worst of the three more attacking sides, Real, PSG and Bayern. So, you know, Ancelotti might still produce something. And obviously Mbappe as well has had this ankle problem. And apparently he's losing a toenail at the moment, which might have affected his performance. Like last night,
oh,
he's got
bless
a month
him.
Now to... Yeah, I know. He's got a month now to figure it out. But interesting ones. Whereas Barca Dortmund, if Dortmund go through that, I'll be astonished.
Yeah. That is the biggest foregone conclusion. I mean, surely. Like, I just do not see a roadmap where Dortmund beat Barca over two legs. I do think Arsenal Madrid is really, really interesting. Because in the post-match stuff last night with like Owen Hargreaves and whoever else was on it on BT Sport or TNT Sport, it seemed like the narrative was like Real Madrid have to be the favourites for the tournament now.
That's so weird.
And I was just like, why are Madrid... I understand like the Champions League hoodoo and the...
They were crap last night.
This is like, I don't understand how people are in the studio. I mean, and again, maybe the quality of pundit goes a long way here, but I do not rate this Madrid team that much. I rate Arsenal far, far higher. And I think the kind of what side of probability of Arsenal managing through this game and being able to mitigate for like Real Madrid's Champions League factor is kind of, is Saka available? Is Saka not available? Is Saka available for both legs? Is Saka only available for the second leg? There's a lot of variables there that are kind of Saka-centric that will have a huge impact on the outcome of this fixture. But everything so far in the Champions League that Real Madrid have produced has shown or pointed to the fact that they will really, really struggle against Arsenal, because Arsenal are such a structured and solid defensive unit. If you look at the games that Madrid have lost in the Champions League, they've lost, if you include last night, which is the, because technically they lost in 90 minutes, they've lost to Lille, Milan, Liverpool, and then Atleti. No team has conceded less than Atleti in La Liga. PSG are the only team that have conceded less in Liga than Lille. Napoli are the only team that have a lower expected goals against in Milan in Serie A this season. And only one Premier League team has conceded less and has a lower expected goals against in Liverpool. And that team is Arsenal. So the four games that Madrid have lost in the Champions League this season have all been against teams that are like pretty watertight defensively, or have been watertight defensively domestically this season. And across those four losses, Real Madrid only scored one goal, and it was a penalty. So Real Madrid are showing a consistent signs of being unable to break down solid defences in open play. And we saw that last night. Like, I think Real Madrid expected goals against Atleti in the second leg from open play was 0.17. They obviously had the penalty as well, but in 90 minutes it was 0.17 expected goals from open play. They've got no goals from open play in the four losses that they've had this season against truly elite defensive teams. And it feels like everything is pointing towards being a conservative, solid defensive structure frustrates their superstars, and then you hit them on the break, and that's when you get big, big chances, because their defence isn't fantastic. And if I was an Arsenal fan, with or without Saka, sure, without Saka I'm a little bit more tentative, but I would still be very, very confident in that. Even if you don't have Saka, your defence is still good. So we saw like Mbappe and Vinicius get super frustrated last night. Mbappe did nothing of note until that one moment where he won the penalty. Yeah. Like for 55 minutes, he was invisible. And then he did that, and it was a fantastic dribble. And, you know, it was kind of a stupid challenge from Longley. But if you are Arsenal, I would be confident in saying that we can do a similar thing, in that we'll frustrate their stars and they'll get one or two moments where they show their like true elite quality. If we can weather those moments, we're in a really good position. And I think up top, who you have kind of will be a big factor in how clinically you'll be on the break when you get the ball and when you go forward. But from a defensive point of view, I would be really confident in limiting Real Madrid's open play goals, like significantly. And they'll be feeding off scraps, they'll be feeding off set pieces. And as long as you don't give them like dangerous free kicks or penalties, if you try and limit the amount of kind of corners and wide free kicks they have, I struggle to see, based on how this Real Madrid team has played and how like clueless they've looked against low blocks and structured defences, I really struggle to see a roadmap as to how they score a lot of goals from open play that isn't just ridiculous individual quality out of nothing.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really positive place for Arsenal to be in.
Yeah, because they've got set pieces themselves as well. Like,
it's
Arsenal have got as good a shot at this as they could have, really. And they can run out actually a few different front lines now. And if they want to play somebody more like a conventional centre forward, then they can play Marino there, but which I think they might do just so they have an out ball. But like, I think it'd be really interesting
if Marino at nine.
Yeah, because I think, you know, Arteta likes to have Havertz there in a big game, right? Like, so that they can. But even if they don't play that, I think it'd be actually fascinating to run out something like a Martinelli and Nwaneri Saka front line. Just like an unconventional centre forward that big centre backs not used to playing against. Like, if you played Saka there, like, that would be really interesting. If you played Nwaneri there, that would be interesting. Like, so I think there are loads and loads of options. And I think Arsenal will go and probably try and make the game absolutely horrible and sneak some set pieces at the Bernabeu. And then at home, I think they will press really, really aggressively, because also Real Madrid haven't been good at handling that so far this season. So it's an interesting one. It's an interesting one. And I am enjoying the Champions League. We're waiting till early April now. But when I look around at these teams, I think 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, like 6 of the remaining 8 could theoretically win it. And I'm being kind of unkind there to Villa. It's totally possible. Villa get past PSG, then I'll revise my assessment of them, because that's a really tough match.
A Villa-Arsenal semi-final is like all better off. That could go either way. The weird, like, same domestic leagues team meeting in the latter stages of the Champions League always creates like a weird dynamic. Like, say, if it's Villa Madrid, I think they get battered across two legs. For whatever reason, even though Arsenal are a better team, I think the fact that they're domestic, they share the same domestic competition.
There's a leveler about it.
There's something weird about it. And then plus, like, the additions they've had, Villa have added, like, Asensio, I think, has 4 goals already in, like,
he's got, like, 7 and 8.
Does he?
Yeah, in all competitions, I think he's got 7 and 8.
And then Rashford's got, like, a handful of assists in 250 minutes. And it's like...
yeah, they're a problem.
They were a good team already, and they've added some components of, like, genuine quality who are actually contributing straight away. Like, that is not an easy game for PSG. I do think across two legs... I think the two legs is a killer for them. I just think it's too much of an ask for them to do it twice.
Yeah, if PSG put them in the tumble dryer like they did to Liverpool in the first half at the Parc des Princes, then I just don't see, like, Villa getting out of that. Villa are not as good a team as Liverpool in any regard. No. But they are more comfortable without the ball, I guess. And that'll be interesting, yeah, because if you get a semi-final of Arsenal versus Villa, that's going to be... Arsenal would probably be the aggressors at the Emirates, but by and large, those are two teams who probably... don't really want the ball in this stage of the Champions League.
And more transitional
that'd be an interesting one.
We'll play into the space. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think it's nicely poised, and I'm excited to see how it goes. Let's move on to the Burn Book. All right, Burn Book time. Pete, you obviously have been like little hold up in baby hermitage this month, but
yeah,
is there anything that's pissed you off? Is there anything you want to put in the Burn Book?
There's many things that piss me off. And so I didn't want to go too like newborn heavy. I figured I'd stretch out that content for as long as possible. Mm-hmm. So I've avoided putting in anything at the minute, at least until next time, that is newborn related for putting in the Burn Book, of which there are quite a few, mainly being like constantly tired.
Sure.
But what I'm putting in the Burn Book this week is the winter sun. Because fuck that guy. We are now into March and it's getting like a bit lighter, a bit sunnier, which is nice. Like it's starting to feel like spring and summer are just around the corner. But while that's nice when the sun comes out, there are few bigger dickheads in history than the winter sun. Because when it comes out, everyone sees it, thinks, amazing, summer's here, spring's here, let's go out. But as soon as you leave the house, for the entirety that you're outside, that sun is just blasting you in the face, blasting you in the eyes, making it a miserable little existence of any time you're trying to do anything. Driving anywhere, can't see anything because the sun is so low in the sky, it's just blasting you in the face. Go for a walk. Oh, the sun's out, so you've only gone for a light jacket, which now you're slightly cold because you've overestimated the heat at which the sun will provide at this stage, which, again, another dickhead move. It's out in full blue, in full regalia, but has the audacity to not heat up at all because it's so far away. Like, we are still 9-10 degrees, but full sun. And for the entirety that you're out of the house, doesn't matter what direction you're looking. You can look one way and then do a full 180 degrees and somehow it feels like that sun is still blasting your corneas. Just burning. And it's such an unnecessary, like, fuck around. Because we've been cooped up for all winter. We've had all these grey, cold, rainy months from, like, October. And then you start to see things getting lighter and brighter. And the sun comes out more frequently. And you're lulled into this false sense of security where it's like, oh my God, it's over. It's done. Winter's over. And then you go outside and it's just like that last little, like, dig that, like, the last knife into Caesar's back from Brutus. It's just like, oh, this is insufferable. And now we've committed to being outside, so now I'm walking around the park without the use of sight because I can't see 3 feet in front of me. All I can see is this bright light at like eye level.
You would have this objection to the winter sun.
Well, I'm just like, I wanted. Okay, so I wanted to be like. So the winter sun, have you seen, this is a weird reference, but I've been watching a lot of random movies recently because I've had a lot of time on the sofa. Bedazzled. Is it Bedazzled? Yeah. But with Brendan Fraser and Elizabeth Hurley, yeah. The winter sun feels like that. You know when Brendan Fraser's character makes like a wish and Elizabeth Hurley grants it, but like fucks it up in a way that like is unnecessary. Sure. The Winter Sun is like that. It like lulls you into this being like, look how lovely it looks outside. And then when you get outside, the actual experience of it is terrible because of the parameters and the position of which the sun has chosen. Well, I suppose it doesn't choose. It's predetermined. But it just makes it such a... something that seems like it should be pleasant, so unpleasant. For me, I would much prefer, like, you know, when they change scenes in the theatre, like the curtain comes down and it comes back up and the backdrop's completely changed. Like, it's like a switch. Mm-hmm. If we can go from like winter to spring and it's just like on, where I think, what, like late March is when spring starts. We'll decide a day, say the 21st of March is when spring starts, and somebody just hits a switch and it goes from winter weather to spring weather. There's no transition period where the sun is like super low. I think that's a much more preferable existence because right now it's miserable. Driving anywhere, can't see a thing. Doesn't matter where you put your like sun visor, sun still gets underneath.
Oh my God. Okay. Wearing
sunglasses helps, doesn't help a huge amount because it's literally just a bright light directly in your eyes.
Oh my God, Pete. It's just like such
a... It's not even warm. It's not even warm.
Yeah, I mean, that is a bit of an issue. But I like it when it's not too warm. If it were like 2 or 3 degrees warmer, I'd be fine with it. I like it when it's still cold enough that I can layer up, but the sun is out and I don't have to deal with it raining all the time.
Just 15 degrees higher in the like angle, 15 degrees higher in the sky.
Okay, that would do it.
2 or 3 degrees higher temperature. I'm fine with that.
Okay. All right. Well, good one, I guess. What am I putting in the bowl? Oh, yeah. Speakerphone. Terrible invention.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened. Like, look, speakerphone, I understand why it exists and there are use cases for it. But I do think that speakerphone and also FaceTime are incredibly annoying. And 90% of the time when they are used, it's not because they need to be used. It's... they're just being used by the most annoying, obnoxious people. I don't know when people decided it was okay to like have a conversation on speakerphone on the bus or on the tube or at the gym. I was sitting on a machine the other day and the guy next to me was just like shouting into his speakerphone and someone was shouting back at him. And I was just like, why are you catching up with phone calls on speakerphone at the gym? Shut up. Like, put some headphones in. It's such a like weird... attempt to dominate that I find it incredibly annoying. And so often, I'll be on the bus or whatever and I'll realize that a person sitting in the seat in front of me is just like FaceTiming someone for some reason.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, am I in the back of your FaceTime? I don't want to be. And why can't you just like put your headphones in and have a normal conversation, you weirdo?
When they do that as well, when they FaceTime people in public on the bus, if you watch them, because to like successfully FaceTime somebody the way it should be used, you kind of need to hold your phone selfie kind of arm's lengthish,
sure,
so you can be seen, so you can probably see the screen. That obviously gets tiring over time, and also you don't have a space in the bus, so most of the time they're doing it, they're actually just showing like the double chin look of and they're not even looking at, they're looking around, so they're actually not getting any of the benefits of FaceTime.
It makes no sense,
but they're providing all of the downsides.
So I'm just sitting there like, I don't want to hear your conversation, and frankly, if I can hear your conversation, then I'm going to say, hi, can you shut up? Like, I really don't understand it. Like, it is like playing the music out loud on your phone thing. I just think, like, that to me is so childish. Like, that's just very clearly people trying to look hard.
That's clearly like a fuck you,
Yeah, it's clearly somebody who's just like, I'm so tough that, like, nobody's going to tell me. And, like, I listen to my music out loud on the tube and you're like, yeah, well done, like, buy some headphones. Like, it doesn't impress me. But this one, I just think is particularly strange. And I don't know why everybody seems to think that public spaces are their sitting room, but they're not.
Yeah. It's become a lot more common as well recently, like in the last couple of years. And I don't know if just some people just started it and it made other people think it's acceptable, despite it never being acceptable. But I see it all the time now. And there's a weird phenomenon where like somebody can be having a conversation near me, two people in real life, standing or sitting like two seats in front of me having a conversation. And that doesn't trigger me or annoy me, or it's not even that much on my radar. Same position, but on the phone. Even if they're like properly using the phone. I don't know why, but that's so much worse. Like it's triggering.
I do think the volume's higher.
Like, do you think?
That is part of what it is. Like, the people like shout into their phones. But yeah, it just feels much more like something is going on that you didn't ask to participate in. Like, I expect to see people interact with one another when I'm out in public, but I don't expect to have to listen to a conversation filtered through like a fuzzy like phone receiver. Like it just I don't know, the whole thing just like pisses me off. Even when it's one side of it, I just think, just speak at a normal volume, like shut up.
I don't understand the benefit though of public speaker phoning, because you're holding your phone anyway. Why not just hold it to your ear?
I just think you're a dickhead. I just think you do exact. I don't think they even think about it. They're just doing exactly what they want. But yeah, that is the thing where I'm just like, I don't get why you've brought your phone to the gym, but you haven't brought headphones to the gym. Like, what are you doing? And I also don't think that you're that serious about the gym if you're sitting and having a phone call while doing an exercise or in between exercise or whatever. Like, you're just kind of messing around. You could just spend less time in the gym and call somebody afterwards if you just concentrate.
I guess part of your routine could be like some form of like low intensity steady state cardio, like walking uphill. I think you could then potentially have a phone call.
Yeah, maybe, but like even then I think like you might as well walk outside. But
sure,
this is somebody sitting on like the hip adductor.
Yeah, but the winter sun's outside, so inside.
Oh yeah, so you can't go outside, sure. So, well, it's Sophie's choice. Okay, but this annoys me, and several times recently I've been in a public place and just for some reason been privy to someone's entire conversation. And I do think that we should become as a society more comfortable shaming those people.
Yeah.
It should be like watching porn in public. Don't do it. It's not acceptable. Shut up. It's a bad example.
I would say porn's arguably more acceptable.
What? Because at least it serves a purpose.
I'm just far more on board with porn than I am with speakerphones.
Sure. If you've got headphones, then sure, maybe. All right. What are you taking out of the burn book?
Okay, so what I'm taking out of the burn book this week are sofa caddies.
Okay.
So obviously we've a newborn. She is 3.5 weeks old at the time of recording. And the way Jess and I are working it is we basically are doing shifts so that each of us can get like solid sleep and like uninterrupted sleep for at least a couple of hours at a time. Whereas I've known parents to like do everything together.
Sure.
And it kind of means that nobody gets sleep then. And the sleep you do get is like super, it's like super bitty. It's like every 30 minutes you're kind of waking up because the baby's beside you and made a noise. So this is kind of at night. So like from about 9, 10 p.m., straight after dinner, Jess will go to bed and I'll take Bonnie and I'll just sit with her on the sofa for like 3 hours. And then I'll go upstairs, wake Jess up. She'll feed her. Like I'll change her and all that, feed her, and then I'll come back down for another 3 hours. And I'll do that until about between 1 and 4 a.m., whatever makes sense, based on like, because your timings kind of fluctuate. But usually I'm going to bed about 2, 3 a.m. And then Jess will put her in the next to me cot beside us and we'll do like 3 hours where we both sleep. And then Jess will get up in the morning and then I'll sleep on. That's what we've been doing. It's been working. But what that means is that like I've got pretty much like 6 hours each evening from like 10 p.m. to like 3 a.m. 6 hours where I'm pretty much just sitting on the sofa, either holding Bonnie or like beside her if she's in the bassinet. And it's meant that like, particularly when I'm holding her, also like these times, I almost just put this in straight up in that like just spending the evenings with her, because it's like just me and her and she's just like sleeping and you have like what seems like an infinite amount of time, but it's also just really pleasant. And you get, like, you can watch a load of stuff. I've actually been watching Band of Brothers for the first time because I knew that you did it this time. So I'm like 4 episodes in and it's fucking fantastic.
It's so good.
It's so good. And there's so many people in it as well.
And yeah, like, you've got like, every, like, they'll just be like, oh, that's Tom Hardy in the background of the scene. But you're sitting there with like your little, it's like having a little pal there and they're just like warm and like sleeping and relaxing. And then every now and then, like, they do a little wail. You have to get up and change them. It's nice.
What I find the funniest is that, like, because obviously they're newborns and they're bad at regulating like temperature and breathing and stuff. She'll forget to breathe for a while.
Sure.
And then her body will shock herself into breathing again, obviously, because it's like the reflex you have. But when she does that, all her limbs shoot out. Like, she startles herself. Like, she doesn't wake up, but she just startles herself back to like breathing again. And it's so funny every time it happens. But yeah, so a lot of the evening will be me on the sofa with the baby asleep watching stuff, which is class. But it is quite limiting in the sense that, like, particularly when the baby's asleep, you don't really want to move them about too much.
Sure.
If you need to go to the toilet, and the upside of potentially waking her is not ruining your sofa, that is fine. Like, that is a risk that is worth taking. If you're, like, slightly snacky, you're like, oh, I could do a bag of crisps. Or like I could do with like refilling my water.
Mm.
That doesn't feel, the risk there doesn't feel justified enough to potentially wake her up.
Sure.
So for a lot of the things that make sitting 3 hours on the sofa palatable or like enjoyable, that pre-baby I would have taken for granted, because I'd be like, if I'm watching a film, I can just pause it and go and get another drink. Whereas that luxury doesn't quite exist anymore. So what I've done is I've bought a sofa caddy, which is super ugly, but it's basically like a foam block with various holes in it.
That's good.
What I do is when we're about to do handover, or when Jess is about to go to bed, she'll have probably just fed Bonnie. So while she's feeding her, I'll go and I'll prepare my little sofa caddy. So I'll put in, like, and often, like, most of the times I don't use anything or don't use all of it. It's just, like, precautionary. So sure. I might put in, like, a can of Coke or limonade. I might put in a beer. It fits wine bottles and wine. Like, my phone will go in there. The TV remote will go in there.
Oh, that's good.
If we have a bottle for her, that might go in there. Snacks, like crisps, cereal bars, chocolate, whatever, that'll go in there. So that it'll sit beside me on the sofa and I'll be holding Bonnie. And I'll have everything I need at arm's length for the next 3 hours, which means I can just be like, sit with her. We also have like a nursing pillow. So like a kind of U-shaped thing that goes around your abdomen. So I think Jess usually holds her, but after a while I actually just leave her in the crevice between my body and the pillow. And she just like KOs, which is class. And then you have the use of both arms, which is nice. but basically I'm just spending between 3 and 6 hours each evening with like a fully stocked tuck shop beside me.
Yeah.
In the sofa caddy, including all my remotes and the phone and all, and her just like sleeping on my chest, and then I just get to watch whatever I want to watch. And even if I don't watch stuff, like there's been a lot of times where I've just not been doing anything, but I've just been like kind of looking at her, maybe being on my phone a bit. I've been like planning to watch something and I haven't got round to it, and I look at the clock and it's like an hour and a half later that I've kind of been doing nothing.
Yeah.
Just with Bonnie, but it's also been really nice.
Yeah.
So I think those evenings are really, really precious. And especially when she's like just fed and changed and like has been burped and sick and all. And she's like super satiated but hasn't fallen asleep yet. Mm. She'll just lie in your arms and just stare at you.
Yeah.
Like, completely placidly.
Mm.
No sound, but just like her massive eyes will just be like staring into your soul.
Mm.
And it's like so sweet. So those evenings have been really special, but they have been assisted significantly by the purchase of a really ugly but useful sofa caddy that I just fill with all of my knickknacks, and it tides me through to just 3 a.m. in the morning.
God, that does sound good, but like, yeah, it's I know exactly what you mean. Like those evenings, the second time around, they were much more fun. Like the second time around, I'd say Emma took more of the nights. Like the first time around, we would share the nights much more because we were doing more formula feeding. The second time, we didn't really do that, partially because I went back to work earlier. But I would do what you did, where I would take her till late, put her down, and then Emma would get up with her in the night and I'd like have her in the morning.
Yeah.
And I don't know, when you're a dad, you do just have to find those moments, because like mums, especially if they're breastfeeding, like do tend to get that time, like that kind of one-on-one time looking at each other. And when you're a dad, like I think the best time to do it, you can take the evenings, and also changing nappies. You're like, when you change their nappy, like often the entire time they're looking at you unless they're, you know, half asleep.
Or screen. And
yeah, sure. But all that time is like good stuff.
Mm.
You really need it, I think, as a dad at the beginning, so you get to know them a bit more.
Yeah, because Jess is breastfeeding, and like every feed we're doing at the minute will be at least start on the breast, and then we'll supplement if needed. Which is why it's, you know, really important that she actually gets proper sleep, because she is getting up every 3 hours.
Yeah.
So like if she can do 2 stints of 3 hours where she's just in the bed on her own and nothing else is in the bedroom, she'll actually get proper unbroken sleep.
Yeah.
But there are limited amounts of like one-on-one bonding opportunities with a newborn because they're so reliant on their mother. So yeah, it's nice that like it's such a long period of time over evenings where it's just me and her.
Yeah.
And also she's not like shitting. Because I do change a lot of nappies, but like when you're coming under like artillery fire, of like you see her puckering up something
from the allies.
Yeah. when you're like halfway through changing a nappy and you can see that like there's something brewing, and you're kind of scrambling to be like damaged imitations here. it's still fun, but it's not as fun as when she's just lying in your arms staring at you.
And you're watching Band of Brothers.
Yeah.
This is so nice. This is so nice. I'm glad you're enjoying it. I'm also glad I'm glad you've got a girl as well. Like, look, yeah. having a boy sounds fine, but like, I just think having a girl is great.
Both you and your wife have sent me separate messages saying, I didn't want to say this at the time in case you had a boy, but I'm so glad you had a girl because they're the best.
Yeah, they are the best. And like, now we've actually got three girls between us. Like, so I think Bonnie and Coco are going to have to duke it out to be Regina. Goldie is clearly Karen. Like, she's so like good-natured and round-eyed. Yeah. Like, she's clearly Karen. But we might get a double Regina situation, which would be a bit of a problem. But it's just super fun. And every week it gets easier and more fun. And like, you know, but you obviously get to know her more and she'll sleep longer. Like when she does her first like 3.5 or 4 hour sleep stint, that's when I remember being like, oh my God, like life might actually one day be manageable again.
She's actually been quite good at sleeping. Like, she will sleep for 3 to 4 hours.
Wow. If she's
like satiated enough.
Sure.
But the problem is that her weight still isn't a birth weight. So like, we have midwives being like, wake her up every 2 hours and feed. Oh. And then like overnight we were like stretching out to 3 hours. So there are many times when we're actually having to wake her up to feed just
That's
to get her
so
weight back up.
Annoying. Oh
but
my
it's
gosh.
So annoying because she like she's so peaceful and she's like out and it's like we need to wake you up because we need you to put on more weight.
That does bode well though, right? You know?
Hopefully.
Like,
Goldie
was better the second time around. Like Coco, I remember it was at like 2 months or something. Before she kind of did like a 3.5 hour stint and we were like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Whereas Goldie, I swear, at like 6-7 weeks, did like a 7 hour sleep and we were like, it was better
That's
to
crazy,
do it that
yeah.
way around. It was better to have the crappy sleeper the first. The Coco ended up being good.
But because you're so like
we were prepared for
it. You're like,
yeah, we were prepared.
Amazing.
And then the second time we were like, oh my God, this is a huge bonus that we didn't expect.
What I don't love though is that I'm going back to work in like 2.5 weeks. Oh, I get 6 weeks paternity, which is class. But we're like 3.5 weeks in. So I've got 2.5 weeks left. And then at that point, I think I'll have to lose at least the late part of the nights.
Yeah.
Because I can't really go to bed at 3 and then get up and go to, particularly on the office.
Sure.
Like I'll be up at 7 and stuff. You know, like it's going to be tough. So we're going to have to figure out what happens then. But at least now for the paternity section, being up at 3 a.m. with Bonnie's class.
Yeah. So that's nice, man. I don't really, I kind of want to leave it there. I'll do a very quick one, which is like, really strong painkillers. That's what I'm taking out of the burn book. So like last Thursday, Friday, I tweaked my back and I do this kind of once a year or whatever. I hadn't done it for a long time.
Is it in the gym?
And I think I did it in my sleep. Like I slept in a weird position and like it's probably exacerbated by like being tired from the gym.
That's such a mid-30s.
It's so annoying, man. It's so annoying, man. If I sleep flat on my back will explode. That's
basically what happened. Oh, you hurt your back? What were you deadlifting? Oh no, I was just sleeping.
Yeah, exactly. But I was just like, well, I was deadlifting, but like, it was not related. But you know, like it was just a little tweak and I still went to the gym on Friday. And then like by Friday evening, Saturday morning, when you're facing down the weekend with two kids, I was like I was limping, like I could barely walk, sitting up, standing, like going from sitting to standing, incredibly difficult. I was just in agony. And then I just went to Boots and I was like, what's the strongest shit you can give me for this? Because I've done like deep heat and Tiger Balm and normal painkillers. And normal painkillers just rarely work for me. Like, I mean, I guess that the dosage they recommend is the same whether you're like a 45 kilo woman or whether you're like a 120 kilo like bodybuilder. And I'm definitely on the heavier end of that. So perhaps it's not surprising that like those things feel less effective for me. But they gave me the 200 milligram ibuprofen. And Cocodamol,
yeah.
And, you know, they give you the whole thing of like, don't get addicted to this shit. And I knocked them back, two of the heavy ibuprofen, two Cocodamol. And genuinely, like 2 hours later, I was like, I did kind of feel like I was going to fall asleep and I did kind of feel insane. but I was also like, I could go to the gym right now.
Yeah.
And I've used them really sparingly over the last few days because actually I find that when I take the Cocodamol, firstly, when I'm seeing therapy clients, I don't want to be drowsy or confused at all. So I don't take it then. But I find that actually when I take it, even though I'm allowed to have it every kind of 6 hours, 4 to 6 hours, like honestly, like 10 hours will pass and I feel basically fine. Yeah. So I think it's been improving faster than normal as well. But genuinely, I was just like, God, I did sort of forget that just really good painkillers do just like knock you the, knock pain the fuck out. And I thought, yeah, just hammering some painkillers and making my life manageable. Because also you don't want the pain to be gone entirely. That's the other thing.
I was like, I want to know. Because then you're going to re-aggravate.
Exactly. I was like, I want to know if there are positions that I shouldn't be sitting or standing in, right? But genuinely, it was super effective the last couple of days and made me able to parent in a way that I wouldn't have been otherwise. Because just like, you know, getting kneeling down to change your baby on the floor, or like picking up my like 3.5 year old, getting her out of the bath or something, like all this kind of stuff was over the weekend. It was excruciating.
Yeah. And things like your back and your neck. I did my neck. I usually do it at the start of every hockey season, but you don't realize how vital all of those muscles are until one of them's fucked. And then everything you do is just uncomfortable or sore. And it's just like miserable for however many weeks it takes to heal. But
I sneezed the other day and like screamed. Like I sneezed and like the convulsion that it sends through your body. Like, you know, your back kind of like snaps when you sneeze.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I was genuinely like dumbfounded by how much pain I was in.
Yeah. Well, what's always good is if you ever have something like, if you ever have surgery or like a serious enough to get like prescribed proper under the counter meds, and you use them all, tuck those bad boys away in the cupboard, because you know, having like a little secret supply of like diazepam, fucking class.
Yeah relaxants, that they're hard to get. And that's the thing about codeine as well, right? You're like, they're like, this is a relaxant, so this is going to knock you out. And I was like, I am relaxed, like I feel tremendous.
It is good for like random shit like that, which you obviously don't justify. Like, you're not going to go to the GP for it unless it gets really, really bad. You're not going to get prescribed like proper pain meds, so you having to kind of go over the counter. Having like that extra prescribed stuff, just in case you need it, top tier. Yeah, top tier.
Liquid paracetamol. I remember being on that once when I was a kid, and it was like, that was a revelation. It was like a religious experience.
Yeah.
Okay, that brings us to the end of this. We got to wrap this one and move on to the paid episode. Thank you very much for listening. Let us know what you'd like us to talk about next time. We'll be back in a couple of weeks, but we will catch a bunch of you over on the paid side, where we'll be answering some of your questions. Thank you very much. We'll catch you later. Bye.